This podcast is brought to you by Intel vPro.
The defense has raised the idea that maybe Cohen messed with the recording in some way.
Like afterwards, Donald Trump would be like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Who would
like,
I be
was
paying?
There a part of the conversation? Because it just sort of like they're just talking and all of a sudden it just ends. So in theory, I think it's a natural thing for the defense lawyers to try to raise the idea of, well, maybe at the very end of this, the part you don't hear, he's like, well, just make sure you do everything legally.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen.
That's exactly what it was. And you've been indicted over that?
I object to you getting one.
Welcome to the Trump Trials Sidebar from the Washington Post. I'm Libby Casey, and I'm here in the studio with
Rhonda Colvin
and James Holman.
And our special guest, Peter Jamison. You can say your own name, though, Peter.
I'm Peter Jamison. Thanks for having me.
It's sort of like in court where you have to actually verify every bit of evidence that's presented to you. Yes. Thanks for joining us. Peter has written a great profile of Michael Cohen, also written about Stormy Daniels. So we're very grateful to have you here to talk about the star witness in this entire case who's on the stand today, Monday, as we record. Michael Cohen. So we're doing a special episode today, sort of an emergency pod. We should have like a flashing light. This is not our normal Thursday taping day, but there is so much to talk about because Michael Cohen is so key. Later on in this episode, we'll also bring back our friend Devlin Barrett to talk about the information and evidence that is so crucial that Michael Cohen, prosecutors believe, has. He is a linchpin in this case. But we'll start by talking about Michael Cohen's journey. And it's been a winding journey from star fixer to star witness. So, Peter, you write about Michael Cohen as being the most famous ex-fixer. I don't know if fixer is a term or a word that people really knew a whole lot about before he kind of came on the stage and we learned behind the scenes about the kind of jobs that he did. You wrote that he would take a bullet for Donald Trump. Can you explain his loyalty and what he actually did as a fixer?
Yeah, so, you know, Michael Cohen played this really interesting role for Donald Trump and within the Trump organization. He was actually talking about this a little bit on the stand this morning, saying that he never actually wanted to be an attorney. He wanted to work in business, work on Wall Street, but that his relatives really wanted him to be a lawyer. And, of course, that's what he ultimately did. And, you know, when he went to work for Donald Trump, which was about a decade before Trump ran for president, you know, while his technical title was, you know, personal attorney to Donald Trump, he dealt with a wide range of issues for him. And you know, he prided himself in particular on being someone who could solve problems that came up for Donald Trump. And that's where this whole idea of Michael Cohen is sort of the Uber fixer came from.
And you dealt with him, James.
Many times. And, you know, fixer was Cohen's word. He would say, I'm Trump's fixer. I think he also wanted to be consigliere. And it is, Cohen himself has said it was like a mob family or whatever, but, you know, he was obsessed with Trump. He kind of ingratiated his way into Trump world, gets a job for Trump. And he really was, I mean, he said, you know, I'd take a bullet for Trump publicly. And now he's kind of the ammunition against Trump from the prosecution.
But I need to explain what it was like, because especially when you had your newsletter, the 202, like you were writing about all parts of, you know, Washington and politics and even beyond. So describe how you would interact with Michael Cohen.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Cohen threatened to sue me at least three times. The one I remember was where I said, we don't know how rich Trump really is, and
truth.
Which is truth. And this was before a lot of the coverage of, you know, the subsequent, this was before Trump was seen as a credible candidate for the presidency. And so I said, Trump may be a mega millionaire, or he may be a millionaire, or he may be a billionaire. And Cohen demanded a correction and said, he's
a
billionaire.
Did he call you?
Yeah, he called. He called. And
did
and
he
I
say
said,
it gently and kindly?
No. So he was like, you know, he's a screamer, and he's quick to fly off the handle and threaten you and cajole you. And he's even, you know, he's talked on the witness stand about how he threatened and intimidated journalists who didn't tell the party line. But literally every serious political journalist in Washington has a Michael Cohen story. A few years ago, NPR ran audio when he threatened one of their reporters. CNBC, Forbes, I know people at the Times, the Journal, Politico, where I worked when he first threatened me. I mean, he's one of those people who just like, he's quick to take things from a 1 to an 11. And, you know, I actually remember in the early years or the early months of the Trump presidency, every reporter spent like every weeknight, not every weeknight, but you were just constantly, the best way to talk to people and get access to people easily was to go to the Trump Hotel bar. And I remember being at the Trump Hotel bar the night before Michael Cohen testified to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And that was actually what he subsequently pleaded guilty, among many of the crimes, being a convicted perjurer is one, to lying to Senate investigators about the nature of his conversations with Russians for a Trump Tower Moscow. And so I remember chatting. Michael Cohen doesn't drink or wasn't drinking then, but he was at the bar and he had just spent all day murder boarding with his lawyers and was preparing for this deposition, closed door, the next day. And I talked to him and he was like, this is total BS. Like, this is the, you know, this is like a hoax. Like, I didn't have anything to do with this. I didn't, you know, and he was,
lying.
And he was lying through his teeth.
He was convicted.
It's not perjury to lie to the Washington Post. I think it's unforgivable, but it's, but he lied about a lot of things. And so it is ironic because, I mean, I knew he was tested. I knew he was doing this the next day. And so he was talking about that. And that was literally one of the crimes that he subsequently pleaded guilty to and served a year in federal prison for.
So, you know, reporters in Washington are used to being yelled at by sources or people who are protecting sources or, you know, important people's people. But what did you get in terms of a sense of how much he cared for or wanted to truly protect Donald Trump? Like, how did he talk about Trump to you?
I mean, he was self-involved. I mean, in this chapter, you know, he's trying to reinvent himself. He ran for city council as a Republican in 2003 of New York. You know, when Trump, we know from some of the testimony last week and from reporting that Cohen really wanted to be Attorney General of the United States, which is like a laughably absurd role for him. He wanted to be White House Chief of Staff. He, after Trump won, he thought he could run for mayor of New York City, in 2017. And so he has delusions of grandeur, always has. He has sort of a messianic complex, but he's also one of those people that, putting aside the anger and the nastiness, he always felt, he's one of those people where every time you like interacted with him, you wanted to take a shower afterwards. He like is just, he's a seedy character. He comes across, if you, reporters have radar, and you can sort of read people, and he was just like I wanted to take a hot shower every time I met him. And so, he's reinvented himself, but I wouldn't say, you know, I think Michael Cohen is what he wants to be that day. Michael Cohen cares most of all about Michael Cohen. At the time, he cared about Donald Trump, but helping Donald Trump, he saw as a way to help Michael Cohen. And that is that's part of his problem, is that's pretty clear to whoever has ever interacted with him.
You know, Rhonda, he was so disappointed when Trump came to Washington and as president, and Cohen didn't come along. As James said, he had some really grand ideas about what he could be doing. But how much of a betrayal does that seem to be in terms of their relationship?
It seems, and it's been reported, as well as one of the preceding witnesses, Keith Davidson, said that he was on the phone with Cohen when Cohen was grappling with the idea that he would not be going with Trump to the White House and was very upset. I think Davidson characterized it that he thought Cohen might commit suicide. He was so upset. So that's already been said on the witness stand. I think the betrayal question is the exact reason the defense is going to go so hard at Cohen to try to characterize him as someone who has an axe to grind. He wanted, you know, political favor and a political position, didn't get it. He didn't receive anything that he wanted and was left out and then started to tell his story. So that is one of the core reasons really makes Cohen a problematic witness in all of this, is that he does have, it would seem that he does have an issue with being betrayed, and that may have compromised his ability to be a star witness. But he is a star witness because he does have, you know, the receipts. He has timelines that no one else has. So whether or not he is credible or has a great character, he is seen as a very pivotal person on the stand in this.
You know, Peter, you really wrestle with this question of like his redemption, or, you know, where he's coming from, his perspective. He has a podcast called
Mea Culpa.
And his books are
Disloyal and Revenge.
What did people tell you about that pivotal fall that he had when he was sort of excommunicated from Trump world and what that did to him?
Yeah, so I think an important thing to notice about this fall is actually just what you pointed out, is the extent to which it's been publicized and the extent to which it's sort of been a media narrative. I interviewed a left-wing, very popular left-wing influencer named Majid Padelan. He has the Twitter podcast Brooklyn Dad Defiant, and you know, he is someone who's very antagonistic towards Donald Trump and has become big buds with Michael Cohen. And he actually compared him to a character in a TV show who's on a redemption arc. You know, I mean, this is like a classic fictional television narrative that Michael Cohen kind of seems to be playing out in real life. And of course, this is the question, is to what extent is he play acting this, and to what extent is it sincere, or to what extent is it a combination or something in between? And you know, as far as why Cohen turned against Trump in the first place, you know, we've heard different things from different parties. It's very clear, as was mentioned earlier, that there was sort of a distancing that began when Trump came to occupy the White House in 2017 and Michael Cohen didn't come with him. You know, Cohen himself has disputed the extent to which that was a factor and disputed the extent to which he actually wanted a job in the White House, although we've heard from, you know, credible sources to the contrary that, you know, he is someone who actually did very desperately want to work in a job in government and work in Washington. But, you know, I think a very key moment is in 2018 when the federal government begins investigating Michael Cohen. You know, he becomes the subject of a criminal investigation. And at that point, you know, from everything that we could see publicly, Trump doesn't really have his back. So, you know, he begins distancing himself from Cohen really not long after the FBI raids Cohen's home and office. And, you know, Trump goes on Fox and Friends saying, you know, this is someone who, you know, just did very minor legal work for me or something to that effect.
Which we know is not true.
Which we know is not true. We know Michael Cohen was a key player in the Trump organization, someone who knew Trump very well. You know, as Cohen testified just this morning, I mean, they literally had their cell phones synced so that Michael Cohen personally had Trump's, whatever, 30,000 contacts or something he said he had on there. But if you're in that role as Michael Cohen and your boss goes out and says something like that to you publicly, you know, it's likely he interpreted that as a signal of kind of what he could rely on Trump for as he faced his own criminal problems. And it's really from that point that, you know, Cohen, while he's being investigated, he begins cooperating, not fully cooperating, but cooperating to a large extent with the prosecutors working on his case. And then, you know, that leads to this sort of dramatic pivot where he goes from, you know, as James was saying, everyone's got their story about Michael Cohen and sort of being bullied and, you know, that kind of thick Long Island accent coming at you over the phone or in person saying, you know, this is going to happen to you if you cross Donald Trump, to that same person, that same voice really, you know, coming in front of Congress and going into these multiple trials and saying that, you know, Donald Trump is this nefarious figure, that he regrets his involvement with him and that he's bad for the country. And so it was really kind of a remarkable transformation.
Let's play some tape from some of the congressional testimony that Michael Cohen gave.
Mr. Trump is a con man. He asked me to pay off an adult film star with whom he had an affair and to lie about it to his wife, which I did. And I'm giving the committee today a copy of the $130,000 wire transfer from me to Ms. Clifford's attorney during the closing days of the presidential campaign that was demanded by Ms. Clifford to maintain her silence about her affair with Mr. Trump.
So that was a tape of Michael Cohen in front of the House Oversight Committee back in 2019. I covered it. I was in the room, probably one of the busiest and most spectacular congressional hearings I've ever attended, and I've been covering Congress for years now. But the hallways were full. There was public seating that went into an overflow room. I remember going into that overflow room to get a sense of how the public took in Michael Cohen. And this is one thing that's really been sticking with me, and going back into my notes from covering that, is members of the public really were supportive of Cohen. When he came in and gave his opening statement, there were a lot of people who were just really fascinated with him coming forward and saying he was going to tell all, that he had been a part of, you know, so many schemes, but this was the moment he was going to just lay everything out and tell the truth, which I think that that informs me right now on how a jury might be listening to Cohen, that yes, he's a flawed character, a very problematic witness. However, when he comes across as someone who has receipts, exhibits, as we saw in that tape, he's showing, you know, a receipt, an invoice. He also had a check that Donald Trump signed. That was a part of the exhibits in that congressional hearing. It was just sort of a strange set of affairs, actually, in that hearing. It was also one of the first times that I remember seeing so many House Republicans really dig into their loyalty to Trump. I think it was the start of that, and we're still seeing it. And I remember from that hearing, Michael Cohen, he was going toe-to-toe with Jim Jordan and many of them on the Republican side. And I remember he said, I have been the same way you all are right now with Trump for 10 years, and it doesn't go anywhere. And so he was saying, I've been where you are. I have been that loyal person.
Loyalty
and
doesn't is a one-way street with Donald Trump.
Exactly. So it was a fascinating congressional hearing to cover, and it really gives you an insight into the type of witness Cohen might be on the stand.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember that day well, too. I mean, it was like there were so many Democrats who were basically like, welcome to the resistance.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, it's like Peter was saying, like, he's a leader of the resistance.
Right, and like, and they were all, and there were people like thanking him profusely, and it was sort of like, okay, like, I mean, subsequently Cohen wanted to run for Jerry Nadler's seat in New York. And
As a Democrat,
and he still talks about wanting to run for Congress someday, and it is...
But I don't think he's still held up as like a figure of the resistance in the same way.
No,
I
mean, he's not. But at the time, it was sort of like, here's a Trump person who's flipped, who's turning and testifying publicly. And it was like, I don't know. I mean, it felt like he flipped after Trump basically cut him off and cut him loose.
Peter, how have your conversations gone with people who are friends with him or in his orbit about this sort of transformation or, you know, where he's coming from, what his perspective is?
Yeah, so I mean, I talked to a lot of people about this transformation, both inside his orbit and outside. And, you know, I'll say to, you know, some of the points that were just made, you know, this is something that Adam Schiff, who, of course, you know, was very important in the first Trump administration, sort of probing many different things about the former president. You know, this is something he said about Michael Cohen when I talked to him, is that, yes, his testimony is important. His willingness to speak out is significant. But let's not lose sight of the fact that this transformation came after Trump abandoned him and showed his willingness to kind of discard him and be disloyal to him. So, you know, the question of how much people are willing to embrace Michael Cohen as a resistance figure, I think, is very much, you know, kind of still an open question. You know, there was a poll that I cited in my story that was taken about a year ago where, you know, there's a very clear plurality of Democrats who view Michael Cohen positively. And that's flipped for both independents and Republicans, where more people view him negatively than positively. But as far as the jury pool in New York City, you know, I think it's important to remember that in New York, Michael Cohen, not to the same extent as Donald Trump, but to some extent, is a familiar figure to these people. You know, he's kind of part of the cast of New York characters that's been part of the very, you know, colorful local political drama in New York City for a long time at this point. You know, people may remember his sort of bizarre run for the city council in 2003. You know, they may remember his sort of, you know, previous life as a taxi medallion mandate. And, you know, for those who aren't familiar with the taxi medallion business in New York, it's not completely synonymous with, like, you know, very high ethical standards. So, but, you know, I spoke to, there was this, and it's true, you know, he kind of mused aloud in an interview last summer about possibly mounting a primary challenge to Jerry Nadler in Manhattan as a Democrat running for Congress. And, you know, I spoke to New York State Assembly member Linda Rosenthal, who's a Democrat and, you know, longtime person who's involved in politics in Upper Manhattan. And she just said this whole idea was was laughable, basically. You know, she called Michael Cohen a reprobate and said, you know, if he wants to kind of come clean and do this 180, that's between him and his God. But it doesn't mean that he automatically earns the trust of people and that he's automatically worthy of holding office as an elected official. Of course, you know, who knows what would actually happen if he ran, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we live in interesting times. And,
we do, yeah, indeed. So. Yeah, yeah. So you were talking to Tom Arnold?
I did speak to Tom Arnold.
Like the actor Tom Arnold? And,
like, yeah, so we should probably, yeah. So Tom Arnold is a, I think I'd basically call him a 1990s celebrity. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, had different things he's been involved in since then, but Tom Arnold, for viewers who you know, might be
might
know,
have been 10 years old,
younger than Gen X, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, he, you know, he was someone who had a role on the original TV show Roseanne. Roseanne Barr is one of Tom Arnold's four ex-wives. So, and you know, he's sort of become like a B/C-list celebrity, but he was someone who became obsessed with finding incriminating evidence about Donald Trump in 2017 and 2018. And he had this television show called The Hunt for the Trump Tapes. And as part of this, you know, he at one point approached Michael Cohen. He just walked up to him in the lobby of a hotel in New York City and introduced himself. They took a selfie. And in what appears to have kind of been a calculated act of provocation, you know, Tom Arnold tweeted out this picture of himself with Cohen saying, you know, hey, you know, Mike, you know, I'm with Michael Cohen. I, you know, he's got a lot of interesting things he knows, a lot of interesting things to say. So Tom Arnold, he tweets out this selfie with Michael Cohen. He goes on MSNBC saying he's talked to him. You know, while this appears to be sort of an effort by Tom Arnold to maybe prod Cohen into turning against Trump, which at that time Cohen hadn't done, the two then strike up this sort of bizarre relationship where they communicate via text message and phone calls. At one point, Michael Cohen actually calls Tom Arnold before he's scheduled to report to prison after he's pleaded guilty and tells him he's actually not guilty of some of the charges that he'd pleaded guilty to. And then Tom Arnold, of course, and I think this is another example of, you know, again, how much all this is playing out in this weird Hall of Mirrors media environment. Tom Arnold is recording that phone conversation and he then leaks it to the Wall Street Journal. So if everyone's head is spinning over all this, you know, I had the same reaction. But you know, Arnold said when he first met Cohen, you know, if Arnold is to be believed, he said that he was kind of on the fence and he wanted to find some way to stay good with Trump and to remain in Trump world while also protecting himself and his family from this criminal prosecution investigation that was a very real threat to him at this point.
And I mean, one of the things that Cohen claims, one of the reasons I don't think he has redeemed himself, is that he claims he was like coerced into this plea deal that he took, which was a pretty generous plea deal, because a lot of the crimes he committed had nothing to do with Donald Trump. He was committing tax evasion. The taxi business was sketchy, and they got him on a lot of stuff that didn't have to do with Trump. And so now he's still out there, even recently, claiming that he was coerced into this plea deal, and the federal judge, he asked for his post-sentencing detention to be shortened, and the judge said, no, you're still lying, even now, about the crimes that you committed. And I mean, I think that's one of the things that I thought that that tape that Tom Arnold released really showed, that Michael Cohen has not actually really redeemed himself.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the problems that prosecutors enter into when dealing with a witness who admits to lying the number of times Michael Cohen has. And he was on the stand this morning testifying that he'd lied. So when a person swears under oath that they lied in the past and that they've lied multiple times in the past, you know, can you believe them? And this is a paradox that the criminal justice system deals with often, but I think it's particularly acute with Michael Cohen because, you know, when he lied, how he lied, for what reasons he lied, those have all become really key issues in sort of his own personal redemption story. And you know, as James pointed out, the you know, the judge who's now overseeing the tail end of his criminal sentence said that when Michael Cohen testified in Trump's civil trial that he had actually lied when he pleaded guilty, to tax evasion, that gives rise to this possibility that either, in fact, he did lie when he pleaded guilty in front of the court, or that he lied at the civil trial and he wasn't sure which one was which. So,
but he was found to be a credible witness. I mean, that is important, right?
In a separate trial.
In a separate trial.
By Judge Mershon.
Yes, right. Yes. And I'm also thinking, too, big picture, is Cohen's redemption really the issue, at least this week? Because the only job Cohen has right now is to prove that there is a link between Donald Trump's knowledge and intent of the payments to Stormy Daniels, to Karen McDougal, and that's it. As long as he can prove that and the prosecution can keep him, you know, on that as a focus, then that's his only job. I think, you know, Cohen, again, I know we've used this word so many times, flawed character, problematic witness, but at the end of the day, his real purpose and utility this week is to just say Trump knew of these payments, and that's the heart of the case.
And if he is found to have lied on the witness stand right now, it would be perjury. So he has a motivation to tell the truth at this point with so much spotlight on this. In this moment, fair to say?
I mean, I'm excited for the cross-examination. That's where this is at. We know, you know, the prosecution gets to control the questions right now. They've been able to coordinate with Cohen. It's when all of a sudden Trump's lawyers are up there trying to rile him up. Mm-hmm. And I know from personal experience, he is easy to rile up. Maybe he's going to be very zen. Maybe he knows that he can't lose his cool this time. But he's someone who's erratic. Mm-hmm. And you know, in my experience, we'll say one thing and say something else entirely 5 minutes later.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, with the congressional hearing, I remember he was so quick with his answers. It mm-hmm. appears he's not someone who gives, you know, a lot of thought to the answer he's about to give, or, you know.
Yeah, his just, mind and his mouth both work.
Yeah,
fast.
Very yeah. quick. Yeah. So I do think it's going to be really important and key in this entire case to see if the defense is successful in riling him up, because mm-hmm. it doesn't seem like it takes that much work to rile him up.
And the prosecution clearly doesn't have, quote unquote, control over him, because he's continued, as our colleague Blair Guild was reporting on and shared with our podcast last week, he's continuing his TikTok broadcast, he's continuing to talk, even though he's pledged to stay quiet outside the courtroom. He hasn't had the self-control or interest to do that. Peter, what will you be listening for as he testifies?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very important point that Rhonda made, and I think it's absolutely correct, that we're not dealing with this sort of larger metaphysical question of, is Michael Cohen a reformed human being or not? You know, it's the question of whether the jury believes what he has to say, and specifically what prosecutors have put him on the stand to say and the information they want to elicit from him. You know, I think that I'll certainly, you know, we'll be watching and listening and following our reporters who are in the courthouse to try to get a sense of, yeah, his demeanor, the extent to which he's unflappable under cross-examination. You know, there's also this key question that sort of lingered over this trial, which is, you know, will the district attorney's office be able to present, other than the other testimony we've seen come in so far, you know, any kind of documentary evidence that corroborates Michael Cohen's claims that Donald Trump was directly involved in this hush money payment, and you know, that he ordered it in order to influence the outcome of the campaign, which, of course, I mean, this is the nexus that makes this case a felony instead of a misdemeanor, is that these were falsifications of business records for the purpose of influencing the election. So, you know, if what we have to connect Trump to that is simply Cohen's testimony, then, yeah, I mean, I think all the typical measures of, you know, someone's honesty and whether they seem to be telling the truth will come into play. I think also, you know, while, you know, Michael Cohen's sort of larger redemption story is not necessarily relevant for the facts of this case itself, it will be interesting to see how much the defense tries to use that redemption story he's told as fodder in their cross-examination. I mean, they've got, and this is, you know, I mean, I think this is why Michael Cohen's, you know, very prolific career as a podcaster has probably given prosecutors and Bragg's office some agita, is that every time you go on and talk about, you know, a criminal defendant, when you're going to be a witness in a case, every new episode, every new time he's gone on television to do an interview, you know, he will potentially say something that is minorly discordant with something he's said in some other time, and they will try to point to that as evidence that his story has changed or that he can't be trusted. And, you know, I'm very curious to see the extent to which Michael Cohen's sort of media existence as a political figure over the last few years comes into play during cross-examination.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the Trump defense lawyers asked Stormy Daniels is, how much money have you made off of telling your story over the years? Mm-hmm. And Stormy Daniels claimed it was a net negative, that it's cost her more than it's made her. But I assume they'll ask the same question, which is, how much money have you made off all these books and this podcast and this TikTok thing? And you have a financial incentive to, mm-hmm. to tell a good story about Donald Trump.
We'll talk more in a few minutes with our colleague Devlin Barrett about that question you were probing, Peter. What other evidence is there? What other witnesses has the prosecution been able to put on the stand to try to sort of get the bear hug around what's at the heart of the case? Mm-hmm. So everybody stay with us to hear from Devlin. Thank you so much, Peter Jamison. Really appreciate your time, and it's great to see you in person. Thanks for
reporting.
Glad to
talk with you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel vPro. AI PCs built for business with Intel Core Ultra processors and Intel vPro are optimized for hundreds of AI apps and tools to boost user productivity, all with AI-powered threat detection. Learn more at intel.com/itheroes.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Welcome, Devlin Barrett, who's been covering the Trump trial in New York and joins us again. Thanks, Dev, for being here. You're heading back to New York to cover the rest of the trial later this week.
Yep. We're moving fast. Prosecutors say they should be done with their case by the end of this week.
Wow. So we only have you here in D.C. for this moment, and we'll take advantage of it. Let's talk about what the prosecutors need from Michael Cohen. What is the key crucial evidence and information that he has?
So after weeks of testimony about sex and tabloids and scandals and various other things, the most important thing is that Michael Cohen, prosecutors need him to talk about what his awareness is of Trump falsifying business records, which is the actual charge that he's facing. I think Cohen has started out his testimony by putting in a lot of stuff that I think is designed to bolster his credibility with the jury, confirming details, even little things like an interaction with the former quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger. All those little small details prosecutors know can add up to building up Cohen's credibility, which is important because there's going to be a big tide of stuff that's going to make him look less than credible, and everyone knows that's coming.
So much of an important part of building a case is the prosecutor saying, look, don't just trust this witness, look at the documents and mm-hmm. the evidence. So what evidence have the jurors seen so far that could bolster Cohen's case? And also, have there been witnesses that sort of verify the chain of money?
Right.
Like, I'm thinking about Hope Hicks. You know, right. Did she help at all? There was a bookkeeper who talked about Trump signing checks.
Right. So there's two ways to think about this. One is there's the basic physical fact of the checks. And by that, I mean Trump is accused of making a series of payments to Michael Cohen, essentially in 2017, paying Michael Cohen back for the hush money. On top of that, though, there's been a series of witnesses who've talked about Trump's awareness of the Stormy Daniels issue, awareness of the Karen McDougal issue. And that's important because, again, at the end of the day, what you need to show is that he knew that he wasn't just paying legal bills. He knew that this wasn't some retainer with his personal lawyer, that this was a reimbursement scheme and that this was all going in the books fraudulently to cover up other, criminal activity.
Who were the people who've talked about that or brought that up?
So, one, I think David Pecker gives you some insight into Trump's awareness of problems. Two, Michael Cohen is in the process of doing that. And I think there were some sort of circumstantial witnesses who sort of, you can almost think of it like a target. And some of those witnesses are giving you the outer rings of the target so that at the end of the day, a jury may be comfortable saying, okay, if I know enough of the outer ring, I know it's at this heart of this thing. Mm.
back on May 2nd. I believe you were in court that day?
Yep.
Okay. I don't know how you keep the days straight because it's like one giant long day and yet very crucial moments in time. So back on May 2nd, the jury heard a tape that Michael Cohen made. And this was a secret recording that he made without Donald Trump's knowledge. He recorded it back in 2016. And they're talking about how to pay money to David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, and it's to pay him back for paying Karen McDougal, the other woman involved right. in this, who said that she had an affair with Donald Trump. So set up this tape for us before we listen to it.
Right, so this is important evidence from the prosecutor's point of view because they think it shows that Donald Trump knew about hush money payments, knew what the plan was, knew what the goal was. And so in the moment that Michael Cohen is making this recording, and first of all, let's just have a quick shout out to the good people at Apple for making it possible for everyone to record everyone else in every social situation. So
although
Michael
not
Cohen,
necessarily legally. Let's be clear. We are not
well, most places are one-party states, so, you know. Michael Cohen basically uses his iPhone to, like, on the down low, like, record this conversation. And it's him talking to Donald Trump about paying the National Enquirer executive back for the $150,000 that the executive shelled out to buy and kill Karen McDougal's story. And what's interesting is, and to be honest, this is probably credible, I think. Cohen says his motivation for making that recording in the first place is he's worried about David Pecker being so mad because Pecker hasn't been paid back and thought he would be paid back, that he wants to keep Pecker sort of on side, on the team, and not break ranks. And so he makes the recording, Cohen says, in order to show and give to David Pecker, you know, the idea that, like, don't worry, man, Trump is going to take care of you. Now, the one flaw in that motivation, that stated motivation, is I don't remember any evidence saying that Pecker ever heard this tape. So if you're going to make the recording, presumably you'd want to give it to David Pecker, play it for David Pecker, so he would feel better about the situation. I don't remember Pecker ever saying that happened. I remember a lot, but I'll have to go back and double check the transcript. I don't think Pecker ever said that. I think we would have noted that at the time. So that's the reason for the tape.
All right, let's roll it. Let's listen.
I need to open up a company for the transfer of all of that info regarding our friend David, you know, so that I'm going to do that right away. I've actually come up and I've spoken to Alan Weisselberg about how to set the whole thing up with funding. And it's all the stuff, because, you know, you never know where that company, you never know where he's going to be. Correct. So I'm all over that. And I spoke to Alan about it when it comes time for the financing, which will be...
Listen, what financing?
Well, I'll have to pay you, so...
No.
I got...
Hey, Don, how are you?
Okay, it cuts off abruptly, but why? Why does Michael Cohen say it
cuts
off?
Cohen says it cuts off because he gets a phone call. Again, props to the good people at Apple. The defense
has argued.
Next time,
put it on do not disturb airplane mode.
So many settings. The defense has raised the idea that maybe Cohen messed with the recording in some way.
Like afterwards, Donald Trump would be like, "I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Who would
like,
I be
was
paying?
There a part
what?
Of the yeah. conversation? Because it just sort of like they're just talking, and all of a sudden it just ends. So in theory, I think it's a natural thing for the defense lawyers to try to raise the idea of, well, maybe at the very end of this, the part you don't hear, he's like, well, just make sure you do everything legally. That's what the defense is trying to raise. It'll be up to the jury to decide if they think there's anything to that.
Yeah, well, speaking of the jury, I know you like to examine jury dynamics.
I really do.
And look and see how they're taking this all in. When that evidence was played, along with other, you know, recordings or any other evidence, what's your sense of how the jury is taking that in? Are they following it? Are they, you know, enraptured by this tape that seems pretty stunning?
I think they're definitely following. I think they're definitely very attentive. A handful of them take very copious notes. Like, a handful of them are just taking notes after notes after notes. They look a little bit like reporters that way. I think there have been times that, especially during the Stormy testimony, it felt a little bit like they seemed a little, some of them seemed a little just uncomfortable with the entire topic. But I think they're very into it. You know, it's always tricky. Covering a trial is a little bit like watching a basketball game, but you don't know the score. Like, you know who's playing well, you know who's playing badly, but the actual thing that matters most, which is who does the jury think is winning, you can't see that. And also a lot like a basketball game, most of the games are decided in the final minutes, and like, we're not there yet. Michael Cohen is an incredibly important part of this case. Having watched the rest of the case, I now am much more convinced how important Michael Cohen is, because so much of the rest of the evidence about Trump's intent and Trump's knowledge is really kind of circumstantial. Cohen is the only one that we know of who can actually put intent in Trump's mouth, as opposed to just the checks.
One of the things I've been struck by is that this is ultimately Trump's former lawyer testifying against his ex-client.
Yes.
Have you ever covered a trial before where the ex-attorney is testifying, is flipped against his client? That dynamic, I don't know if that matters to the two lawyers on the jury, you know, but
it might. It very
feels,
well might.
It feels unusual that, and it's obviously not the first time Cohen has testified. He also testified in the civil case as well.
Correct. And I think it does matter. It may matter a lot to those two lawyers. It is rare.
But matter in what sense? Like, they might find it
matter in that
unappealing,
I think most
or
lawyers,
shocking,
right.
Or
I think most lawyers would feel like, you know, this has been a betrayal of the basic premise of the profession. But I also think, like, one of the things that jury has to wrestle with is just the degree to which almost every single witness has said that Michael Cohen, they didn't like Michael Cohen, that Michael Cohen was a terrible person, unreliable person, a problem creator, not a problem solver. And so what the jury makes of that is one of the things I'm dying to know. But I think now you're going to see, like, Michael Cohen. And the other sort of fascinating thing about Cohen is I think most people who dealt with him in daily life would call him, you know, a hothead. Maybe not that exact word, but that idea. And one of the things that's amazing about court, and this is a little similar, I think, for Stormy Daniels' testimony, too, is that court is a very cool medium. You are not hot. Most people in court who are hot do poorly. And so you're bringing the temperature down on a lot of these people. And Cohen is starting very cool, and that's good for him, and that's good for the prosecution. Question is, can he stay cool during the cross?
And to your point, James, about he's Trump's former lawyer, he was Trump's former lawyer when he recorded him surreptitiously in that tape we just heard.
With the intent to play to someone else. He's disbarred, by the way. He's no longer...
I mean, it's an amazing dynamic. And I think we've been covering the Cohen-Trump saga for so long, it's easy to forget how wild this dynamic is. But it's also worth remembering, Trump has had a lot of lawyers who have essentially turned on him publicly. And Trump has had a lot of lawyers who have basically become indicted or unindicted co-conspirators to him. Being Trump's lawyer is clearly a very dangerous profession.
One of my favorite jokes in Washington is that MAGA actually means make attorneys get attorneys.
Yep. Yeah, and that's been going on back to 2017.
Yeah.
Devlin Barrett, thank you so much. We look forward to checking in with you later this week when you are back in New York in the court, in the chilly, chilly courtroom.
Yes, we'll have more on that as we go. we're hard at work. The investigative reporters are hard at work on the temperature question.
Figuring out the HVAC system of the New York courts. Thanks so much, Devlin, and thanks so much,
James.
And Rhonda.
And I'm Libby, and you can catch us on Thursday. That's when we will do our regularly scheduled episode. Of course, subscribe to the Trump Trials newsletter by going to the Washington Post website, and subscribe to us by going to youtube.com/Washington Post or wherever you listen to podcasts. See you Thursday.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel vPro. AI PCs built for business with Intel Core Ultra processors and Intel vPro are optimized for hundreds of AI apps and tools to boost user productivity, all with AI-powered threat detection. Learn more at intel.com/ITHeroes.